Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Marge Baker of People for the American Way, who discusses her group's concerns regarding William Barr becoming Donald Trump's next attorney general. Stacy Spell of the anti-gun violence group Project Longevity, who explains why he believes that rampant gun violence across America is a public health crisis, where communities must come together to take action. And Jerry Ashton, co-author of the book End Medical Debt, who talks about his tax-exempt charity that locates, buys, and forgives individual medical debt. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On November 29th, a Honduran court convicted seven people of the brutal murder of indigenous rights activist Berta Cáceres, a winner of the prestigious Goldman Environmental Prize. Cáceres was killed at her home after years of harassment for opposing the $50 million Agua Zarca hydroelectric dam in March 2016. Mexican activist Gustavo Castro was injured during the attack. The Honduran investigation of the killing of Cáceres was deeply flawed and condemned by both the slain activist's family and indigenous rights activists. For a year and a half, government investigators failed to review a large cache of information. Early on, the court limited the scope of the inquiry to the individuals directly involved in the killing, while ignoring the critical question of who hired the hitmen. Several of the defendants had ties to key executives who worked for the dam's owner, DESA. Violence exploded across Honduras after the 2009 ouster of Honduras' left-leaning president, Manuel Zelaya. Gangs connected to the current conservative regime have stolen land and natural resources from indigenous people and small farmers. Still, the Trump administration solidly supports Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez. After 8 years of severe budget austerity, the British Chancellor of the Exchequer, Philip Hammond, pledged to restore funding for health, transportation, and small business in the latest national budget from Prime Minister Theresa May's Tory government. However, the Resolution Foundation, which campaigns for improved living standards, argues that the budget restorations will have little impact on public services. The budget released in late October by Prime Minister May is heavily weighted in favor of tax cuts and benefits for the wealthy. The top 10% of income earners will receive more than 10 times more benefits than Britain's poor. But the political debate in the UK is now dominated by strong disagreement over Brexit, Britain's negotiated exit from the European Union. In West London, food banks are coping with a doubling of demand over the last 3 years. In September, thousands of school principals marched on the Prime Minister's office to demand more funding, and police chiefs say they don't have the funds to combat rising crime. According to the Resolution Foundation, the Tory government would need to increase spending by some 20 billion British pounds to end its austerity policies. Harsh budgets in recent years have cost the poor over 600 British pounds a year in buying power. Driverless trucks are going on test runs along Interstate 75 in southeast Florida. Cameras and radar sensors mounted on truck cabs relay data to a computer center in Jacksonville, over 300 miles away. Long-haul trucking is seen as a prime candidate for driverless vehicles. A driver would be on board to handle difficult situations and to drive the final leg of the trip to a transportation hub. The bulk of the trip would be controlled by artificial intelligence, or AI. Supporters of driverless technology maintained that AI-powered trucks would be much safer on the road. However, critics worry about the loss of blue-collar middle-class jobs, where workers often make upwards of $70,000 a year. In the 1980s, most truckers owned their own rigs and made a good living. A decade later, many were on salary and were often paid on a per-mile basis. Today, the trucking industry complains of a driver shortage and high turnover. A 2017 report by the International Transport Forum predicted that the adoption of driverless trucks could cut the demand for human drivers in half by 2030 in both the United States and Europe. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruth Ann Baumgartner.
After months of enduring public insults by President Trump, Attorney General Jeff Sessions was forced to resign on November 7th. In his place, Trump appointed Sessions' chief of staff, Matthew Whitaker, as acting attorney general, a conservative activist who has publicly criticized special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into allegations of Trump campaign collusion with Russia in the 2016 election. 1 month later, on December 7th, Trump announced his nomination of William Barr to be his next attorney general. Barr, who served as the late President H.W. Bush's attorney general from 1991 to 1993, would, if confirmed by the U.S. Senate, oversee the Mueller investigation. In his public comments, Barr has attacked the Mueller probe and defended Trump's call for a new investigation and prosecution of Hillary Clinton over debunked allegations of wrongdoing in a uranium mining deal approved by the Obama administration when she was Secretary of State. Investigative reporting recently revealed that Barr had sent an unsolicited 20-page memo to the Justice Department on June 8th that condemned Mueller's inquiry into potential obstruction of justice by Trump, saying it's based on a fatally misconceived theory and would cause lasting damage to the presidency and the executive branch. Your reporter spoke with Marge Baker, Executive Vice President for Policy and Program with People for the American Way, who discusses her group's concerns regarding William Barr becoming the nation's next attorney general.
Sessions, as attorney general, did just about everything wrong. I mean, it was an all-out assault on civil rights, on efforts sort of pulling back on reforms to prevent the militarization of local police departments and rolling back attempts to curb police abuses and litigating against the rights of LGBTQ people and supporting draconian immigration policies and supporting voter suppression. I mean, you can go on and on and on. He had a horrendous, horrendous record. The one thing he did right is recuse himself from overseeing the Mueller investigation, and that's what led to his being fired. And the president, as we know, has put in this acting so-called attorney general, Matt Whitaker, who had been Sessions' chief of staff, with absolutely no background that would support his being in the position. In this position, it was a way to get rid of Sessions. And now, of course, he's nominated William Barr, about whom we have some really serious concerns, both around rule of law issues and also around his civil rights record.
Summarize some of those concerns, if you would, about William Barr, as he is poised to win confirmation in the Senate, given the Republican majority there now.
Well, first of all, on the rule of law side, I mean, remember, we start with Trump wanting someone who will be a loyalist. He went after Sessions because Sessions wasn't a loyalist. He put Whitaker in because Whitaker was a loyalist. He said he wants his Roy Cohn, who was the top aide to Joseph McCarthy and during the 70s was Trump's fixer, personal lawyer and fixer, who got things done. That's what he wants. He wants somebody who's totally loyal to him. And remember that the attorney general position is not the president's lawyer. The attorney general position is the people's lawyer. He's a lawyer for all of the people of the United States, not for the president. But nonetheless, that's who Trump wants in this position. And Barr has, in addition to you had mentioned his role during Bush 1 in pardoning several figures involved in the Iran-Contra affair. And those pardons directly undermine the special counsel who was charged with investigating the wrongdoing in Iran-Contra. Walsh, who was the special counsel, in his biography apparently says that he was apparently so concerned about Barr's hostility to the investigation that he was conducting of Iran-Contra, that he, Walsh, rushed to complete a final report for fear that Barr would shut down the investigation. So real concerns about Barr's complicity on pardons. But he also has a very expansive view of presidential power. He subscribes to the so-called unitary executive theory and believes that essentially the president needs to do everything he can to push back, not just against congressional incursions, but that, for example, he's unlikely to believe that a sitting president could obstruct justice. And so there's real concerns about his subscribing to that executive theory that essentially holds the president above the law. He's also been critical of the Mueller investigation. He defended Trump's decision to fire Comey. He had at least one conversation about becoming Trump's defense attorney, so taking on a position that Rudy Giuliani now has. And he at one time said there was more basis to investigate this totally scurrilous and debunked theory about a Uranium One conspiracy involving Hillary Clinton, more basis to investigate that than Russian interference in our elections. So on rule of law issues, on whether this is somebody who is going to stand up to the president and be the people's lawyer, not the president's lawyer, and really make sure that there's no interference with the Mueller investigation, we should be seriously concerned. We should be seriously worried.
Marge Baker, what do we know about William Barr's track record when it comes to criminal justice reform, holding police departments accountable for violence they commit and abuses against the civilian population they're supposed to protect, civil rights protections, voting rights suppression, immigration enforcement, all very hot topics under the Trump administration?
Barr's civil rights record is truly concerning. And I should say, especially where you have concerns about whether the rule of law is being protected, the one area where you'd want to make sure that the laws are enforced and enforced fairly is in the civil rights arena. And his record is concerning there. On criminal justice, he has a very draconian approach to law enforcement. Back in the Bush era, he fostered a system of mass incarceration that disproportionately harmed communities of color. In 92, he endorsed a Justice Department report that was about the case for more incarceration. And more recently, he's been a vocal supporter of harsh mandatory minimum sentences. So on criminal justice, there's a very concerning record. A concerning record on LGBTQ equality. Back in mid-90s, he wrote a law review article arguing for a return to, quote, traditional morality, end quote, based on, quote, natural law, end quote. On immigrant rights, he supported Trump's Muslim ban, the first ban, the one that all the courts overruled. He supported that ban. He's got a very concerning record on a whole set of civil rights issues, and I expect more to be exposed, you know, during the course of both investigations and during the preparation for the hearings that will happen in January.
That was Marge Baker, Executive Vice President for Policy and Program with People for the American Way. Find more analysis and commentary on William Barr's nomination for Attorney General by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A panel convened at the Yale University School of Public Health on November 27th addressed the topic of gun violence as a public health issue. The forum was organized by three public health students who wanted to promote dialogue about the role public health professionals can play in addressing gun violence in America. Panelists included academics and community advocates, including Poe Murray, chair of the Newtown Action Alliance, a gun control advocacy group formed after the 2012 mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Murray asserted that evidence-based research and other support from public health professionals is critical to the continued push for stricter gun laws at the national, state, and local level. Another community speaker there was Stacy Spell, a former New Haven police detective and current program manager of Project Longevity, a community-based organization working to reduce violence in Connecticut's major cities. In this excerpt recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, Spell talks about the importance of resilience and building community cohesion as a precursor to effectively address gun violence.
For those that live in the inner city who are poor and of color, they've recognized that gun violence is a public health issue long time ago. I once worked as the community organizer for the Community Builders, which is in Kensington Square. It's off of Chapel Street in New Haven, a short distance away from here. A few years ago, there was a 2-year-old child shot on the front porch. And speaking to the neighbors and speaking to the children, they would say, well, do you come outside? No, we're not allowed to play outside. We're not allowed to ride our bikes. We're not allowed to sit on our porch. We're not allowed to go to the store unaccompanied. The fact that the rate of gun violence that we have throughout the nation, and that we don't remove our blinders and say that it is a public health issue, is wrong. I think for those of us that don't wear blinders or have scales on our eyes, we have to inspire those elected officials to pull their heads out of the sand and look around them. Look at the communities and how they're being affected. I suppose one of the greatest tragedies that's happened in our country happened right here in the state of Connecticut. We have incidents of violence throughout the inner city, whether it's Bridgeport, Hartford, Waterbury. What more needs to be said that it's a public health issue? When young children are plagued by post-traumatic stress syndrome, when their health is impeded because they're not allowed to have healthy social development from being able to play outside or interact, we that don't have those scales, we have to speak loudly. We have to speak with a loud voice. We have to speak with a loud collaborative voice, because the power is not in just my loud voice. I have a loud voice. I'm a bad man by myself. But guess what? When we put the voices of all those that are here in this room and we speak collectively with the same message, they have to listen. So as Paul says, it's about building coalitions. For Project Longevity, it's about creating those coalitions, bringing more people to the process. And we just have to speak louder and more forceful, and we have to hold our elected officials accountable, because they're doing us a disservice by turning a blind eye. Marginalized communities view themselves as undervalued, not listened to, ignored, and the key factor, the key word that I will use, is empowerment. When you empower a community, when you link arms with them, and I'm not asking that you bring resources in, but when you help them to strengthen their voice, add to their narrative, because those incidents, like I said, they're happening every day, but they're viewed as not a value. We have to find a way to empower communities so that they can right the wrongs for themselves. In my community, and I can only speak mainly from my past experience, my past experience has always been advocating, let us not wait for the cavalry to come. We are the cavalry. If we wait for the cavalry to come, most of us are going to be slaughtered. So we have to have some self-determination. And having groups link up with you, help you define your narrative, giving voice, at least credence to those communities that might be overlooked. Although, you know, they're just black and brown, and this has been happening to them forever. No. For those of us who don't have scales on our eyes and don't have blinders on, it's time for us, time for others, to lend a hand and become part of the process. You know, it's always been said, either you're part of the solution or you're part of the problem. If we know that this is happening and we just let it go on daily, year after year, and we do nothing but sit by on the sidelines, are we doing anything to help the problem? It's building stronger coalitions, giving credence to underserved communities, helping to empower them so that they can empower themselves. Lastly, I'll say one of the committees I work with is we have a group that's made up of quite a few different disciplines out of the Yale School of Medicine and School of Management, where we have been working for, I want to say, about 7 years and building community cohesion in the aftermath of gun violence. So you will notice naturally in communities where there is a natural disaster, whether it's a flood, a snowstorm, hurricanes, communities have a way of being resilient on their own. This is the average New England snowstorm. You get out there and you're shoveling, you're walking, your neighbor's out there, and you help the neighbor, and then you help the neighbor across the street. That's cohesion. The stronger we make communities cohesive, and for Project Longevity, we're weaving a fabric where together we will save lives. The more people we bring into it, the stronger the fabric, the stronger the impact we're going to have on the violence, especially in violence prevention. Let's not wait till it happens. Let's get ahead of it. So it's all those factors for marginalized communities, and I can't speak enough on it.
That was Stacy Spell, program manager of the Connecticut-based anti-gun violence group Project Longevity. Learn more about community organizations fighting gun violence by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Americans rack up more than $100 billion in unpaid medical debt every year. According to a CNBC report, medical debt has been the leading cause of American bankruptcy for many years. The report found that unpaid medical bills affect the finances of 2 million people annually. In fact, an estimated 56 million adults will feel the negative fallout from unpaid medical expenses, which amounts to more than 20% of the American population between the ages of 19 and 64. Additionally, unpaid medical debt harms the doctor-patient relationship, causing many patients to forego needed care, which often worsens their condition, requiring more expensive treatment. Inspired by Occupy Wall Street activists who captured the imagination of millions in 2011 for confronting rising inequality in the U.S., two veterans of the financial services industry, Jerry Ashton and Craig Antico, founded the group RIP Medical Debt. The project first gained national attention in 2016, when HBO's Last Week Tonight with John Oliver worked with the charity to abolish $15 million in medical debt. Since its founding in 2014, the nonprofit has abolished $120 million in medical debt for about 60,000 Americans. Your reporter spoke with Jerry Ashton, who, along with co-authors Robert Goff and Craig Antico, wrote the new book titled End Medical Debt, Curing America's $1 Trillion Unpayable Healthcare Debt. Here Ashton talks about RIP Medical Debt's mission to buy and forgive medical debt on behalf of individual donors, philanthropists, and organizations.
As people who are professionals in the debt industry, we were a known quantity, and debt buyers and collection agency people are pretty bum. Nobody really talks about what they do or how they do it. In fact, the less publicity, the better for them. But they do have a market, a huge market, in which, financed by banks, debt buyers will go to hospitals, and about 30% of all hospitals will participate. They'll go to the CFO, and they'll say, well, I see you have $100 million for the debt there that's just sitting in your files. $100 million doing nothing for you. I'll give you 5 cents on the dollar. Now, from a pure business point of view, getting $5 million of something over $100 million of nothing is a compelling business case. So hospitals will sell that debt. The sad thing is that once the debt buyer owns that debt, they own it in its entirety. So that when they pick up the phone or they're sending out letters or they're setting up lawsuits, it's for the full amount owed, not for what they paid for it. So if they got a $5,000 bill you owe, which they paid $250 for, they're going to go after you for that $5,000.
And so you turn this whole business enterprise on its head by organizing contributions to buy people's debt for pennies on the dollar. So the next question I have is, how did you select people who are going to benefit from this largesse, from this gift of debt forgiveness?
As a charity, we have a criteria that has to be met in order for someone to truly be considered a charitable case, a needy person. And they can be in one of these three categories or all three. Number one, that they're 2 times the poverty level or below. The second would be that they are insolvent, meaning their assets are less than their debt. Or they could be in what the government calls hardship, where they're spending 5% or more of their annual income out of pocket to cover medical expenses. So those are the three criteria that we use when we do our analytics to determine who is going to be receiving our charity.
Jerry, how have you collected contributions to pay for this debt and to allow for debt forgiveness for so many people? As I've read it, your group has helped over 250,000 people so far get freedom from their debt. How have you attracted contributions for that purpose?
It wasn't easy. because when we first started out with the Rolling Jubilee, there were many people that were more than willing to donate money to abolish debt, just on the face of it. And it was contrarian. It spoke to a need that wasn't being met. So they had pretty decent influx of money. So when we stepped into it, we didn't have the cachet of being occupiers. We were just a couple of former bill collectors who wanted to continue a good thing. So we struggled until John Oliver came along. When he did that show, at the very end of it, 5 minutes, he said, "We're going to be donating this debt to RIP Medical Debt," and our logo appears above us, his right shoulder. And he says, "Because of their 501c3 status, this debt will be abolished and no tax consequences to the recipient." And he gets up and he hits a big red button. Money comes down from the ceiling and our website crashes.
That's great. So donations poured in after that point?
They poured in. And we have a saying, you know, if they don't know about you, they can't do anything about you. So what he did was to give us the first national exposure. And from that point on, that's when we attracted people who came to us and said, "I like what you're doing. I want to help support it." And we have individuals and organizations that pony up so much money every year to cover our overhead, so that money that comes in by way of donations goes directly to the purchase and abolition of that debt. Our goal is to abolish $1 billion of medical debt. Now, that was pretty brash, we thought, when we came up with it in 2014. Scott, by the time December 31st rolls around, we probably will go over the $500 million mark.
Wow.
And then we would like to imagine that next year we're going to finish off the other $500 million and meet our goal. And then we got to rethink our petty little thinking and start getting big.
That was Jerry Ashton, a founder of RIP Medical Debt and co-author, along with Robert Goff and Craig Antico, of the new book titled End Medical Debt, Curing America's $1 Trillion Unpayable Healthcare Debt. Learn more about RIP Medical Debt by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WOOL in Bellows Falls, Vermont, KTWH in Two Harbors, Minnesota, FRSC in Santa Cruz, California, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Ruth Ann Baumgartner, Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.